is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
You know, I think Jay Billis's book on toughness defines it really, really well. But that true toughness that I think basketball teaches better than anything in the world, that's our fourth pillar, and we have really tried to live by that. We try to evaluate our season on it. We try to select our players based on those four things. You know, everything we do, I want it to be based on that, and not to worry about wins and losses and those things.
Carl Kramer has been the head varsity basketball coach for Archbishop Moeller High School for 29 years. In those 29 years, Coach Kramer has compiled a 575-157 record. His teams have won the Greater Cincinnati League 22 out of the last 26 years. He has also led his Crusaders to 7 city championships, 14 district championships, 8 regional championships, 1 state Final Four, in 2005, 2 state runner-up finishes in 2010 and 2017, and 5 Division I state championships in 1999, 2003, 2007, as well as back-to-back titles in 2018 and 2019. Coach Kramer has also received a great deal of individual recognition. He's been named the Greater Cincinnati League Coach of the Year 14 times, the Ohio Coach of the Year 3 times, the Cincinnati Coach of the Year 7 times, the Southwest District Coach of the Year once, the Greater Cincinnati Basketball Hall of Fame Coach of the Year twice, the National Federation of High Schools Mideast Region Coach of the Year, the Cincinnati.com Sports Award, and the USA Today State of Ohio Coach of the Year. In 2010, Coach Kramer was selected to coach in the prestigious McDonald's All-American Game. He also coached the Ohio-Kentucky All-Star Game in 2001 and 2003, as well as the Ohio-North-South All-Star Game in the year 2000. Coach Kramer was inducted into the Moeller Hall of Fame in 2004 and the Greater Cincinnati Basketball Hall of Fame in 2013. Make sure you subscribe to the Hoopheads podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, please leave us a 5-star rating and review. Believe it or not, those ratings help your friends and colleagues find the show. If you really love what you're hearing, recommend the Hoopheads pod to someone and get them to join you as a part of the Hoopheads Nation. You're going to want to have a pen and paper ready, so you can take some notes as you listen to this episode with Coach Carl Kramer from Moeller High School in Cincinnati, Ohio. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast from Moeller High School in Cincinnati, Ohio, Coach Carl Kramer. Carl, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Mike, for having me on. I'm excited to do it.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun to talk to you tonight and just get your perspective on high school basketball, on college basketball recruiting, on having some of your players getting ready for the NBA, and talk to you about your back-to-back state championships here in the state of Ohio. So let's start, though, by going backwards to when you were much younger and when you decided that coaching was going to be what you were going to do for your career. Do you remember a specific moment or when you knew that coaching was going to be a big part of your life?
You know, really, Mike, I don't have like a specific moment. I think growing up in Troy, Ohio, grew up, had 2 older brothers, played a lot of basketball in the driveway, lived right outside of Troy, Ohio, went to Miami East High School, played basketball all through grade school, all through junior high, was a decent player, just really an average basketball player. When my high school career at Miami East was over, and I had a great time playing high school basketball and football, for me, I wasn't going to be my father wasn't in a position. He was a bricklayer. He wasn't going to be able to send me to a school, and I wasn't scholarship material. So I really was kind of done with sports. And I went to college, went to Eastern Kentucky University, and really got very entrenched in academics and got entrenched in student government. And I always laugh now. I think so much of really the skills that I think it takes to run a big high school basketball program, I kind of learned in those years. I was able to get very involved in the politics locally and even statewide, and representing my university. I went to Washington, D.C. three or four times lobbying during that time. And I think those skills actually helped me better. And I really wasn't thinking sports. And then when I graduated, I wanted to teach. I always had this. I came from a family of teachers. And so when I got into education, coaching kind of fell on me. And then I caught the bug.
Gotcha. So when you mentioned that you gained some skills from student government that are translatable to running a basketball program, what are some of those skills that you think back on that you picked up during that time when you were at Eastern Kentucky in the student government that you still put to use today in your program?
You know, really, even in that, I kind of look back now and I smile, but putting together a team of people around you, we were lucky enough. I actually was student body president 2 years. And in those days, we're back in the early 80s, and it was like that was the whole world. We had all these problems on campus we were going to solve, and we just had a team of people that we got together. And I think early in my life, I learned that great things can be accomplished as long as no one cares who gets the credit, and you work together, and everybody has a meaningful, viable role in the process of what you're doing. And kind of learned that in those days. I actually had the moderator, he was vice president of student affairs at Eastern Kentucky, Dr. Thomas Myers, kind of took me under his wing and taught me a lot of this. And I can tell you that even today, you know, we've got one sign that hangs in our locker room, and it's something that Dr. Myers used to always say, great things can be accomplished as long as no one cares who gets the credit. And so those kind of things, I think, really influenced me and led into the leadership things that really coaching is about. It's about leadership.
So what was your first coaching job that you got, and what do you remember about stepping out onto the practice floor for the very first time with your very first team?
Yeah, so Mike, it's so funny. You know, I've been in it so long now, and everybody thinks I'm a dinosaur, and I wasn't like these guys who, you know, so many of my former players have gone on and coached, and gosh, they learn so much when they play college basketball. I didn't have that advantage. I just was a small high school player, and so it's kind of a long story, but I, in a very lucky way, got the job at Moeller. I was teaching seventh grade in Lexington, Kentucky. Was at a wedding, met a guy who told me about an opening at Moeller High School. And I'd always heard about the athletic tradition of Moeller. And I was excited about that. And next thing I knew, that following week, I got a call to go interview there. And I interviewed. I got the job right away. Now, Moeller back then was a lot different. I don't know how much you're aware, but Moeller was just a dominant football power.
Absolutely. Absolutely. When I was a kid, I remember.
Yeah. Yeah, Jerry Faust had just gone off to Notre Dame. You know, they had a high school coach go to Notre Dame to be the head coach. And it was just a huge power. And I remember in my interview, and I got the job to teach history and English, but they said to me, you know, if you coach here or if you teach here, you got to coach two sports. So I end up, you know, I said, what's open? They said basketball. I said, I'll jump all over that. And then the only other opening was tennis. Now, I'm a son of a bricklayer. I've never played tennis in my life. So, but I got that job, and I drove kids around to where they needed to be. And that's really how my career started. But I would tell you, that first year of coaching freshman basketball, though I wasn't very prepared for it, immediately, I was hooked immediately. It was the most exhilarating thing I'd ever, even all the student government things I was able to do, it was like crack cocaine. I was addicted very, very quick, and then really went to work to try to learn the game. And so that's kind of different than most guys who are in coaching the way I am now.
All right, so I have two things for you. One is I started out my career coaching tennis as well. So and I did play a little bit of tennis when I was a kid. It was actually the last sport I gave up before I started focusing on basketball, but that was in like sixth grade. So I don't know that I was super qualified to be a tennis coach. However, I spent 4 or 5 years at the beginning of my career coaching tennis. And like you, you know, drove kids around and went to the matches and tried to offer at least a little bit of insight to earn my paycheck. But I do think also when it comes to the basketball side of it and, you know, getting started in the seventh grade, you mentioned that you were hooked on it immediately. What was it about the process of coaching basketball? Can you point to like one or two things you're like, man, I love this aspect of it right from that very first day? What was it about coaching that got you hooked?
You know, I think it's hard to define it, but I would use the trite term. It's the process. It is having a vision for a group of guys, getting them to all buy in, and then you feel that process beginning to develop. And if you're lucky enough at the end of seasons, you know, the team's really evolved and really understood what it needed to do to be successful. And I just find that really fun. And getting everybody, I've always felt like I never want to evaluate a season by wins and losses. There are so many different factors that go into that. But if you get everyone in the boat rowing in the same direction, and then there's something really exhilarating about that process. And that's what I fell in love with.
All right. So when you think back to that first experience that you had, and then you think back to a couple months ago when you win your fifth straight state title.
Not straight, but five over my career.
Five overall.
Yeah.
So what are some of the things that you mentioned that you went about learning the game? And so obviously there's an X and O piece, and there's also the culture, the team piece of it. What do you do? What have you learned over the course of your career that helps you to get everybody in the boat rowing in the same direction? What are some things that you do to enable you to build that type of camaraderie within your program today, and maybe compare that to what you did maybe initially as you've gotten better at it?
So, you know, when I first started, I was a lower level coach for 6 years. And again, Mueller, probably from like 1960 when the school opened to 1990, I think we only had maybe five or six winning seasons. There were some good players and some really good seasons. Byron Larkin played at Mueller before I got there. Mike Sylvester, who started Dayton, had been at Mueller, but they never had like multiple years of success. So the culture was different there, and we knew there was something that we were going to have to do to change that culture. So when I became the head coach in 1990, and it was a difficult thing. It was mid-year, and the guy I was working for got let go, and I felt really conflicted, and he was a great coach. In fact, he was my mentor, and he encouraged me to take the job, and I did it, and I knew then I really needed to go out and learn the game at a whole nother level, and so what I did then, I assume you're familiar to some degree, but Coach Don Meyer was running a camp down in Lipscomb College.
Absolutely.
And I camped down there with Coach Meyer for like seven straight years. And they were so thorough in how they taught and how they ran their camp. And I was able to steal so much. So all that I didn't get as a college player, not being a college player, I really felt like those early years in Don Meyer's camp, fundamentally and even how to play and X and O wise, it just, those were the most formative years for me. And then I think to build that culture that I think has been our strength over the years, we just had a belief from the very beginning, Mike, that we just got to make basketball important and basketball fun at Mueller High School. And it's no overnight process. I never wanted our people to think about it's going to happen overnight. It was going to be slow, but by brick, we were going to make playing at Mueller fun and bring a culture of basketball to our community. And, you know, I'm really proud. If you look over our 30 years that we've been doing it, we've literally gotten better in every five-year segment. We've never stopped growing. And even today, you know, our last 5 years have been our best 5 years from a win-loss perspective, not that that's everything. And I just think it's building it brick by brick.
So what do you do specifically to to get your kids to have fun, to make basketball important, what are the things that you've been able to do, that you've been able to bring your kids into the fold to get them to come to Mohler, first of all, and then secondly, to be able to, once they're there, to make sure that your program is serving their needs as a kid in terms of making sure it's fun, making sure that they want to be a part of the program, to making sure that the Mohler community is going to come out and support your program. What are some specific things that you do in order to make that happen?
So, you know what I would start with, Mike? The one thing I learned early, so I'm a product of a young guy or an old guy now, but when I started there in the 90s, you know, it was still kind of the post-Bobby Knight years. And so many coaches that I ran into were Bobby Knight-type coaches. And I knew early then that negative coaching eventually was going to get coaches fired. It wasn't working. Kids were changing. But I also knew that kids really want to be pushed. So you got to find that way of really setting a bar high, but convincing them that they can do it. And, you know, the one thing I think we've had in our program from the very beginning, we decided on four core values, and the coaches that I'd picked up early, and we've picked up such great coaches over the years. And heck, now I've got 13 coaches on my staff. We got the largest high school staff in America. But in those early years, we decided these are going to be our core values. And we're going to talk about them all the time to our kids. Every kid who comes to our camps is going to know these four core values. It's who we are. And eventually, what our goal was is the kids start teaching those core values. And I think we started that in the beginning, and we grew it kind of slowly. And we have the same core values today. And I would tell you, you could grab any fourth grader in this area who comes to my camps, and he could tell you our four core values. And I just think starting with that helped build the culture of doing things the right way.
All right. So what are those four pillars?
So for us, number one is arete. It's something I stole from Don Meyer. Don Meyer used to talk about, it was one of the things that they used in Lipscomb's program. It's a Greek word. It means perfect in its English translation. And obviously it's not being perfect, but it is trying to, everything that we do, from every film session to every warm-up session to every drill, we're trying to do it absolutely our best. We're never going to roll the balls out. If we run a clinic for grade school coaches, this is my thing to our coaches, it's going to be a rate. It's going to be the best we can make it, or we're not going to do it. So just a commitment to excellence. Everyone says it a different way, but that was number one. Our number two thing, and again, very much influenced by Don Meyer, team attitude. You know, we were going to emphasize that, you know, everything's about your attitude, and attitude has to be about others first. And, you know, again, I think we've really done a lot of things in our program to sell that over the years. The third thing is first class. We want to be first class in everything we do. We talk to our guys about character. I don't ever want kids walking around roller basketball players the hallway like they're better than anyone else. I want them to be humble. I want them to have integrity. And it's just the whole way we carry things. I would hope, Mike, that if you ever saw us play, and after we leave a gym somewhere and you sneak in our locker room, it'll be perfect. It'll be better than what we found that locker room. And we really make an emphasis of that to our kids. And again, I just think that starts to build a culture about that leads toward togetherness and winning. And then finally, it's toughness. And, you know, I think Jay Billis's book on toughness defines it really, really well. But that true toughness that I think basketball teaches better than anything in the world. You know, that's our fourth pillar, and we have really tried to live by that. We try to evaluate our season on it. We try to select our players based on those four things. You know, everything we do, I want it to be based on that, and not to worry about wins and losses and those things.
So I'm guessing in the beginning, when you first got the job, that a lot of those things had to initially come from you and you
yes.
setting that example, you being the guy that was driving yes. those core values. But I'm guessing that now what happens is that you're more of an overseer of the culture, and the older players in your program are now, I'm guessing, driving that culture to the younger players in the program and to each other and holding themselves to that standard. Is that kind of what you found and what you've been able to build?
Mike, you know what you're doing. If it's going right, that's what happens. I would tell you that if you came to our banquet, we give no awards at our banquet. There's no most valuable player, no leading scorer. All that stuff gets taken care of during the season by newspapers. And I mean, you don't need to do all that. At our banquet, you don't even have adults talk a whole lot. One of my coaches will give a talk on the year. I will introduce players. But our seniors every year get up and give the speeches. And when you have, and then we have every kid in the program, all 20 freshmen we keep and 15 JV kids. And these seniors talk about these core values. And I don't tell them what to say, but it's just the tradition's kind of been passed down. And they just do a wonderful job of, you know, just talking about their teammates and talking about what it meant to be in the program. And, you know, I call our banquet the single most important day of the year. Every kid has to be there. It's mandatory. And just what you said, it's our players passing down the tradition.
What's the most memorable senior speech at the banquet that you remember?
Boy, we've had some great ones. I mean, really, really great. Like kids' movement, they're so articulate. I will tell you, I had a kid named Tony Rack, who played at Northern Kentucky University, and now Tony is currently coaching at Western Carolina as a as an assistant to Mark Prosser, Skip's son. And so Tony's really, really into coaching, but he was my point guard. And junior year, he was getting ready to become our point guard. And I'd had a meeting with Tony early in the year, and we were talking. Again, I think coaching so much about one-on-one with players and getting them right. And I asked Tony, I said, what's the most important thing you think about being a point guard? And Tony gave me all these answers about, well, you know, you got to score big baskets. He's giving me all these different things. And I kept saying, no, I don't think so, Tony, I don't think so. And in the end, after we had this long discussion, I took out a note card and I drew a line in the middle of this little 5x3 note card. On one end, I put W, and the other side, I put L. I said, Tony, it's about wins and losses. Point guards deliver wins and losses. You do what your team needs by leadership, by every phase of the game. I said, it's not about scoring. It's not an assist to turnover ratio, all that stuff. It's really about leading your team and finding a way to win. And he was a great competitor, and again, good enough to play at Northern. He wasn't a pure point guard. He was really more of a two. And we won the state championship with him in 2007, his junior year. And we had a great team. We actually won the AP pool his senior year, but then we got knocked off in the district. But in his senior speech, he tells this story. And he's telling the story. And at the end, he steps back and he pulls this card out of his pocket. And he said, Coach, here's the card. And I got marked on here in my two-year career as point guard, 46 wins and 4 losses. And he put it down next to me. I was sitting right by the dais. So kind of interesting, you know, that he had kept that the whole time and was proud of what he had done.
Yeah, that's very cool. I think it's one of the things that is so fulfilling about coaching is that, you know, you say things and you have these conversations with players, and oftentimes the seeds of what you planted, you don't see the results of them for 6 months, a year, 10 years, 20 years, where your players look back and it may be something that you might not even remember saying to them, but that they remember that has a greater impact on their life. And I think that that story does a great job of illustrating that point, that
yes.
as coaches, as teachers, as adults, we oftentimes forget about the impact that our words can have on kids. And that story just brings it to light that here's a conversation that you had with him, and all of a sudden, boom, at the end, banquet, yeah. it comes back out. And you may not have even, you know, thought about, hey, this really did have an impact on the way he went about his business during the time that he was playing. But yes. it certainly did. And that's to me what it's all about.
I agree. In fact, it's the relationships with kids that, you know, I love the game. I love watching the game. I love watching college and pro basketball. But I would tell you, it really is the relationship with the kids that make it special.
Yeah, there's no question about that. So I want to jump to that part of it. And then I want to jump back to a couple things related to the core values that you guys put out for your team. And let's talk about the relationship piece of it. And talk to me a little bit about some of the things that you do on a daily basis to help build the relationship with your players. And obviously one of the advantages that you have that unfortunately a lot of coaches don't have today is you're in the building with your kids.
Yes.
And I think that makes a huge difference. And it's one of the trends that I'm a little disappointed to see that we don't have more coaches that are in the building. And obviously there's a coaching shortage and we could probably talk about that to no end about why that is. So we have a lot of coaches who are no longer teachers or who aren't teachers in that particular building. And I think it's such a disadvantage. So talk a little bit about what you do to help to build those relationships with your kids day in and day out, both in school, on the practice floor, game night, however it is that you go about doing that.
You know, so Mike, I would say, you know, it's kind of evolved over the years. I think you're right. I think to be able to be, I'm not sure I could coach if I wasn't able to be in the building. I think that'd be so difficult, at least in the way we try to do it. But I will tell you, I've got four really, really good varsity assistants. And those guys are all out of the building. And I will tell you, they do an amazing job at building the relationship with kids. One of the things that we have done that I think has really helped build community, and I think community, you have to build that sense of community on your team. We travel every Christmas, and we actually travel even a lot in the preseason. We'll do an overnight retreat during the preseason. We do it actually right before Thanksgiving. We'll have a scrimmage on a Tuesday night, and then we go to Athletes in Action in Xenia, Ohio, and start our retreat that night. And then the whole next day, it's not basketball. It's all about us and our goals and how we're going to deal with adversity when it comes. We talk about all that stuff. But we spend some time getting to know our team that way. And then when we travel every Christmas break, I have found it to be, you know, we've gone out west multiple times. We've played in San Francisco like three times, San Diego, been in Phoenix, played a lot on the East Coast, and we've played in Florida a lot. But those trips really mean a lot to building, and not just with our team, but even with our parents, Mike. I mean, you're down in a hotel in the morning. You've just played a game that night. You're getting ready to play someone good later. You're going to film study afterwards. And that whole community, I think, when you're together in that hotel, has really helped our program become closer. Something that when young coaches call me a lot, and I recommend, now, I know it's hard. Our athletic department's never paid a penny of that. We have raised every penny of every trip we've ever taken. I just think it's something that's really special to do with your players.
When you can get away and sort of be entirely team focused, which we all know with how busy life is for everybody,
yes,
that it's easy to get distracted when you're home and there's always other things that are going on and can be kind of going through kids' minds. So I think when you do have an opportunity to get away, it's kind of like that team that plays well on the road because they're so dialed in and focused, and that's the only thing they have to worry about. And I think that's the same thing that you're talking about here, is that when you're on that trip, you just get an opportunity to interact and be focused on what your team is all about and the players and the relationships. And that to me is so key to be able to develop.
I agree so much, Mike. I'll tell you, we always play well when we travel. And I mean, this is a 20-year trend. And I have a philosophy. I think one thing is sleep. We do a better job at controlling sleep.
I could see that.
You know, we have our last meeting every night. If we're on the road, we're going to meet at 10:30 or 11, and guys are going to bed. And we collect their phones. And guys know that, so there's not a lot of complaining anymore. They meet us at breakfast. We give their phones back right away. But we are really committed to trying to get them 9 or 10 hours of sleep. And our teams always play with great. We'll play 4 games in a row in Myrtle Beach at the Beach Ball Classic, and our energy level is great. And I think a lot of it is we get to control their diet. Probably, yeah. We get to control, yeah, their sleep. Yeah,
you're probably 100%. You're probably 100% right on that, because I can vouch for functioning on very little sleep, as you can tell. You're staying up late with us tonight to do the podcast, so I could probably function a lot better on 9 or 10 hours of sleep as opposed to 3 or 4 that I get on a nightly basis. So,
Jason, when you get my age, you never get 9 or 10 hours. You just
we're in the same boat. I'm in the same boat as Mike, especially with these playoff games. I've been staying up late watching all the playoff games, and. Yeah. You know, just with this podcasting stuff too, we're up, me and Mike are both up real late every night.
Registration is now open at www.headstartbasketball.com for this summer's Head Start Basketball Camps. We'll be hosting camps this summer in Strongsville, Westlake, Avon Lake, Oberlin, Brunswick, Highland Heights, Mentor, and Hudson. At Head Start Basketball, we care deeply about making a positive impact on the lives of young basketball players, both on and off the court. It's through building strong relationships with our players, parents, and coaching staff that we are able to use the game of basketball to enrich the lives of those we interact with, both inside and outside of our organization. We believe that our attention to detail, our growth mindset, and our commitment to lifelong learning allows us to help our players achieve their fullest potential. We are passionately committed to providing players, parents, and coaches with everything they need to reach their goals. These core values run through everything we do. Check out our website, www.headstartbasketball.com, and discover why you should attend a Head Start Basketball Camp this summer. Hope to see you there.
All right, so you mentioned phones. So obviously when you started coaching, phones were not an issue. So at what point did phones become an issue, and at what point did you start to formulate a policy/way of handling the phones and your players' social media? And I don't know how involved you get in keeping track of what they're doing on there, but just talk a little bit about some of the challenges with technology and your players, and what are some of the things that you have to think about that maybe you didn't have to think about 10 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, I think phones, you know, even as an educator, you know, I think phones have changed everything. And you have to address it to some degree. You know, for us, we talk to our guys, and we're pretty direct about what they're allowed to do on social media with our team. You know, they're allowed to put a picture of themselves up there, but I don't let my guys get up there and make comments ever about the game that was just played or any of our opponents. If they do that, they know they're dealing with me. That'd be a violation of our team covenant, and so. I wanted to be proud to be a Mueller basketball player, so I want to look on their Twitter and see that, you know, they're identifying as that. But we're just not going to ever talk in the media. It's just not consistent with our core value of first class. So our guys have been pretty good about buying into that in terms of use of their phone. And I think on their phone, I do think all kids are on their phone a lot. And I think it does keep them up at night. And, you know, so that's harder for me to deal with. But we've been pretty direct with our guys about what they can have on social media and what they can't. And I do have a few of my younger coaches. I'm not real good on all that stuff. I'm not on Snapchat or Instagram. But there are some of our younger coaches and alumni guys that if they see something they're uncomfortable with, they'll call me and say, "Coach, you might want to talk to so-and-so, he's got this on his story," or whatever it might be. So we are kind of keeping an eye on that.
You never thought you would have had to manage that back in the day, right?
No, I did not. No.
Yeah, that's very funny. All right, I want to jump back to your core value of toughness. And first of all, get your definition of toughness. And then from there, jump into how you go about developing that type of toughness in your team.
You know, Mike, I don't have like a quick witty thing. We just talk about all those elements. We always say it's not the phony toughness. It's not somebody's out there who's trying to start a fight, or those guys are usually the least tough real guys. You know, we talk about dealing with adversity. We talk about taking charges. We talk about getting a rebound on the backside, just battling every possession, having your hands up on closeouts, all those things that require discipline and toughness. That's our big thing. And I really do like Jay Billish, of course, in his book, Toughness. And we have our guys look at that and make presentations. When we do that retreat that we do, some of the guys will take our core values and they'll make presentations as to what those things mean in our program. And so it's just that general idea. I think to teach it, I when I first started coaching, I used to do a lot of the stupidest drills in the world. We'd have guys, we would. And I look back now and I laugh, like, what were we thinking? We'd have guys on their back, two guys, and we'd roll the ball. They'd have to get up and then dive after the ball, and guys were getting hurt left and right. And
right.
I actually think you're doing the opposite of teaching toughness. You're just banging your guys up. You're wearing them out. Over the years, to me, the biggest single way to teach it, we're really big on film. So we start our practice every day. I have the guys that work out of the building, so we don't start practice till 4:30. And so from 4 o'clock to 4:30 every day, we watch film. Now, we may not watch 30 minutes of film. It may be 15. But I think the biggest thing you can do, and we film all of our practices, every great effort play we make, I'm going to show it to our guys. Like, so if a guy in practice one day takes a charge or dives and saves a ball and creates a situation, just on an effort play and a toughness play, we are showing that. And guys everyone wants to be recognized for what they do. I think you have to make those things important in your locker room. We have a charge board in our locker room. So anyone who takes a charge, practice or game, they get their name up on the charge board. Those are the things that I think motivate kids and really makes it important to the culture of our team.
Yeah, I think when you recognize something that you want to emphasize, yes, that's when you get more of it. Yes. And it becomes easy to say, hey, we want to be tough or we want to do this. But then if we never recognize those moments when kids are doing those things, then very quickly kids understand and get the message that, well, coach says it's important, but he doesn't really ever show us that it's important by recognizing when I do those things. And so then those behaviors tend to disappear. So I think that's a great point that you make for any young coach, old coach, whatever, that if you want to see more of something, you've got to figure out a way to publicly praise that particular thing. And when you do, I think the kids are going to step up to the challenge. So you guys are obviously, with your kids, you're watching a lot of film. How much film are you yourself watching on, let's just say, to prepare for one opponent, how much film are you personally watching?
You know, and this gives me a chance to kind of give you one of the unique things in our program. I'm not watching a ton. The one thing about our program that is different than other programs is, most head coaches do everything and make everything. You know, as I look at even teams we play, the head coach is so much the dominant center of the team. I think I'm kind of the I certainly set the tone, and I have that responsibility to be in charge of the team. But I'm telling you, if you came into one of our practices, Mike, Jason, you wouldn't even know who the head coach is. You would not know who it is. All of my coaches coach equally. I believe in this philosophy of a community of equals. I've got a responsibility as a head coach, but all of our coaches have like key responsibilities that they do. So we have a coach, Mike Sussley. He actually coached college basketball for a long time. He coached for Skip Prosser. He's really been the driving force behind our program. He's just an energy guy, but he does a lot of our preparation. He watches a lot of the film. Fred Hesse will watch. Mike does more of our opponent's film. Fred Hesse, who is a former head coach at Hamilton Bayden for a lot of years, Fred watches a lot of us. So he'll be putting those clips up there. I mean, we'll show where kids make mistakes, but we show a lot more positive. Fred is kind of in charge of putting all that together. So a lot of the film that I'm watching is what they have put together for the team. You know, being principal, although I don't have a ton of time during the day to do a lot of that. So that's kind of how we work. It's like five guys working together and doing different things. And I think it's worked really well for us.
Yeah, that's great to be able to have, you know, the staff that you have to be able to do that and help out. And you have guys, obviously, who are enthusiastic about watching the film and getting down. How much easier is it for them now in the last, again, 7-8 years with the advent of Huddle and Crossover and all these services that break down film compared to the olden days when we were with the VCR and hitting the buttons and trying to tape stuff? I can only imagine how much more efficient you can be as a coach today with your film work than you could be even 10 years ago.
Yeah, Mike, you're so right. It's changed. Like even going to state, it used to be so hard when you were getting ready to go to the state tournament to get tapes and you're running around. It's so easy now on Huddle just to get whatever you need and be able to prepare for it. It's been a blessing for us because we do pride ourselves on that preparation side, and our kids believe that we're really good at being prepared to play people. So it's been a blessing.
All right, let's talk a little bit about your staff and the way that you utilize them and some of the things that you do to help them. I know that one of the things that we've talked to some other coaches about is just the need for you to have assistant coaches who are loyal to your program, which obviously it sounds like you have that taken care of without any problem.
Yeah.
And then also talk a little bit about your responsibility as a head coach to help to prepare those coaches who may want to eventually go and be a coach at their own program. Can you talk a little bit about what you look for in an assistant and then how you go about empowering them? You already described it a little bit in that, you know, in practice, all your coaches are coaching, but just talk about how you put together your staff and what you do to make sure that all those coaches feel valued and that they're all contributing to the overall success of the program.
Yeah, and I do think it's one of the single most important elements in having a long-term successful program in high school. You know, we just kind of got lucky, Mike. Over the years, we would pick a guy up. I picked up Mike Sussley early. We had a young man play for us, and he graduated in 98. He was a good high school player. He wasn't a star. Went to Ohio State and ended up coming back home to Cincinnati and started coaching for us right away. So like in the 99 team that actually won the state championship for us, he was actually one of our coaches. And he has evolved over the last 20 years. He is the prime strategist in our program. It's not me. It's Danny Jerkowitz. Danny is the smartest coach I have ever been around. He's that guy who, Mike, who can go and he can watch a game and just so when a dead ball comes, he can tell you what a play three minutes ago, exactly how they set it up and how they ran. He's just kind of I've never seen a guy have the mind for the game that he does. And then on top of it, he's really, really a good teacher. So, again, if you came into a practice, you would see Danny doing a ton of work directing both offense and defense for us. Now, all of our coaches are involved, but he's the best at it. So just like you would with your players, the guys who are best at it, those are the guys that are going to do it. And so, you know, he ends up being with us for 20 years. Danny owns his own business. I mean, I don't know how he does it. He leaves work every day. He fights traffic to get over. He gets to Moeller by 5. We've already started. But he's committed to it. He loves it. He has a passion for the game. And I will bend however I can just to keep him involved. And again, a former player, it's really neat to kind of see that happen. And, you know, then we've picked up some guys who coached at some other schools and they've become a part of us. And then for us, like I haven't had a lot of guys go get head coaching jobs because once they kind of get on our staff, we're blessed. I think being a large Catholic all boys school, we just have great kids. And this year's team, just with the greatest group of kids And I think when guys get to be a part of that, and we have a lot of camaraderie on our staff, I just haven't had many guys leave. Now, Matt Rooks was a really good player for us. He went on to become head coach. He's now at Wyoming High School. Tim Edmonds became a head coach. He was actually at Wyoming before Matt's now taken over, and Tim's going to watch his son play at Findlay. So we've had some guys go get Division I jobs, and we've had a few others over the years. But basically, the guys come into our program, they stay because we just enjoy it. We enjoy each other.
Yeah, when you can have that continuity, I think it makes a huge difference in building, again, not just a one-off, one-year team where you might have success, but if you're really going to build that program to where you want it to be, yes. When you can keep that continuity in your staff, I think that's huge. And again, you all get to know each other. You understand what each of your coaches' strengths and weaknesses are, and that trust and just builds up more and more year after year after year after year, to the point where you, especially as the head coach, I know that's one of the things that when I spent 13 years as an assistant coach at the varsity level, and one of the things that I'm probably most proud of that someone's ever said about me is my head coach was Phil Schmuck, who's now at Twinsburg. Mm-hmm. And Phil one time told me, this was long after we had stopped coaching together, and he said to me, Mike, he goes, the one thing I appreciate you about you more than anything is that, he goes, I always knew that no matter what happened, that you were going to be loyal and that I could trust you to do the things that were going to be necessary for our program to be successful, whatever those things were. And there was nothing that made me feel better about what I had accomplished during the time that I was there. Because as an assistant, you know, it's not your record that's out there in the newspaper. It's not your record that's being critiqued by people. It's not your decisions that are being critiqued. And so it's easy sometimes to get lost in the fray of, you know, am I accomplishing the things that I want to accomplish? Am I helping the program to be successful? And for him to say that again, many years after we had finished, you know, meant the world to me. And I think that, you know, from hearing you talk about your guys, I think you would probably say the same thing about them, that whatever the program needs or whatever you need, they're there to step up and do those things to make the program successful. And to me, that's really what it's all about. That's what being an assistant coach is really all about.
No doubt, Mike. It's really, when you're looking for assistant coaches, get guys that don't have big egos. I love Popovich's statement one time. He said, I'm only going to bring guys in here who are over themselves. And if you get a guy in that he thinks it's about him, it's just not going to work. You know, the other thing, you know, we've had great players here, and I've had like great dads. And I've had dads who've wanted to come in the program and want to coach. And I always say, I'll never take a dad as a coach on my staff, ever. I don't care how good his son is. I won't do that. And because I just don't believe it ever works. And I always say, if afterwards you're still interested, I'd be more than happy to talk to you. And I've actually had that happen a few times. One was Mike Sylvester. You may be familiar with him. He was a great player at UD. After his son Matt played at Ohio State, made the big shot against Illinois.
Right, yep.
When Matt was done playing, you know, Mike came on my staff at that time, and that was awesome. But I just think you have to have – you have to have guys that are all bought into the mission, and it can't be about them. If it's about them, it's not going to work. And you need players like that too. I mean, that's, you know, for me, you know, I'm getting older in my career now, and, you know, I'm 59. I'm wondering how many more years I'll do it, Mike. The thing I think I will miss most is the camaraderie with the coaches. That scares me. Not having that, I don't hunt or I don't fish. I don't, you know, my thing is hanging out, you know, after a game, we go out and we have a drink and, yep. You know, we talk. That to me is, I said earlier, relationship with the players. And actually, I love seeing the growth of players. In high school, I don't know if you have the same relationship you might have in college with players, but really it's a relationship with the coaches I coach with that I think I would really miss.
Yeah, I will definitely speak to that, because when I decided to leave high school coaching, and that was, I think, in maybe 2008 or 2009. And obviously for the totality of my life up until that point, I had always had a basketball season. And one of the scariest things for me was to leave coaching and to not have a basketball season. And it ended up being that wasn't nearly as traumatic as what you just described, which is I missed the guys. I missed hanging out in the coach's office after practice. I missed the conversations after the games. That was what I missed. I mean, I loved the basketball piece of it. I loved the X and O piece of it. I loved being a player and being in the locker room and all that stuff. But ultimately, what I missed more than anything was just the hanging out with, whether it was my teammates when I was playing or whether it was with my fellow coaches when I was coaching. And that's the one thing that, honestly, the podcast has sort of been, I don't want to say a replacement, but it's been that same sort of thing. I'm getting a lot of the same satisfaction from the podcast that I got out of those conversations in the coach's office, because I'm getting to talk to great guys like you and all these different coaches from all over the country and doing all kinds of different things. And that to me is just, that's what it's all about. And I can totally relate to what you're saying.
He gets to hang out with me a lot too.
I get to hang out with Jason. I get to hang out with Jason a lot more than I used to. So, you know, we hole up in his basement and our wives wonder what the heck we're doing. Disappearing a couple, you know, used to be a couple nights a week. Now we're down to one night a week, cramming in as many podcasts as we can in our one night away from our families. But I can totally relate to what you're saying there as far as the camaraderie with your coaches is really, it's really critical.
Yeah, it really is.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about college recruiting, because obviously with the success that you've had with your program, you've had numerous players go on to have the opportunity to play college basketball. Can you talk a little bit about how, from the perspective of a high school coach, college recruiting has changed from the beginning of your career to now where you are after having won 5 state titles and been coaching for a long time?
So, Mike, I would say right when I became the head coach in 1990, that was right at the advent of the AAU thing. So I really saw kind of you could see it switching and more recruiting was going to occur in the summers. And that's kind of what happened. I would tell you, we have been blessed. We've probably had, I don't even know the number, but I'm going to say probably over the 30 years that we've been doing it, over 40 Division I players, and then a lot more who've played in Division II and NAIA and different things. I think we have like 15 kids playing college basketball right now from our program. So we've dealt with all the different levels. I think we're a little bit blessed. I think being Moeller and having a lot of good players, college coaches still are very good about reaching out to me. We seldom have a kid get recruited that they don't go through our program. I know I talked to our baseball coach some, and really for him, he will have guys get offers from school that he doesn't even know it. It all happens in the summer in baseball. But for us, I would say even when our guys are with their AAU programs, most of those coaches reach out to us and keep us in the loop. And I tell you, in my experience, I've had very few bad experiences with schools recruiting. We've had a few. We've had some guys pull offers and so we've had to deal with that. But for the most part, I have found most of the college coaches and the assistants that have come in our school on a regular basis to really be great guys and really honest about the process. It's a tough business, you know, and they've got to get it right when they make their decisions.
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge. And I think that if you're a college coach, you want to be able to gather as much information as you possibly can, whether that's through talking to the high school coach, whether that's through talking to their AAU coach, whether that's watching games in the regular season, the high school season, the AAU season. And I think the more information that you can gather, the better off you are. I think the challenge nowadays for college recruiters, at least in my estimation, is that now there's just, I think the skill level in high school basketball from player 1 through 12 is probably higher than it's ever been. Now, I don't know necessarily that the basketball IQ of every player improved, but I think the skill level of high school basketball players is very much improved over the course of the years. And so I think as a college recruiter, it's got to be tremendously difficult to be able to parse through all the players and go through and figure out which guys can play at which level and which kids are we going to target and know whether they're going to be a culture fit. And it's got to be a thankless job for those guys who, you know, go out. And I'm sure that when they go and talk to high school coaches like yourself, that they're looking to gather the type of information about the kid and not necessarily their playing, because I think they probably can get a pretty good handle on what the kid can do when they watch them play. But I'm sure they're trying to get a better handle on what kind of kid they are.
No doubt about that. No doubt.
If you're a basketball coach in the greater Cleveland area and you have a passion for teaching the game and might be interested in joining the Head Start Basketball Camp coaching staff this summer, please reach out to us via email at headstartbasketball@usa.net.
You mentioned that you have one of your players that's going to be in the draft, Jackson Hayes from the University of Texas, and it looks like he's going to fall somewhere. We just saw the NBA mock draft. They have him going 10th to the Atlanta Hawks. And you mentioned that you had some conversations with NBA people. I think this is something that people out there maybe aren't aware of, that these NBA teams are going back and talking to high school coaches and probably people that are in these players' lives in other different capacities. So can you talk a little bit about what NBA GMs and NBA personnel come and talk to you about when they're looking at a player like Jackson, and what they want to know from you as his high school coach?
Yeah, just to put some perspective on it, Mike, there's no coach been more blessed than I've been in our coaching staff. We've had such good players over the years and really had a good fortune. But we've never had a kid even really get close to the NBA. So all these years, 29 years, I really have not had a lot of good college players, but not anyone really close to the NBA. We've had a lot play in Europe. We've had a lot play in South America, Australia. But the NBA is a brand new thing. So I would say early in the year, during the season, and actually kind of interesting because of tonight's lottery, the Pelicans called me during the season. And that was the first call I've ever gotten from an NBA. And I'm like, who are you again? And I knew Jackson was blowing up and doing great. And so that conversation went a long time. And since then, I would say most of the NBA teams you've just mentioned have called. Whereas college guys will call me and they'll say, hey, can he stay in front of a good athlete? Can he learn? They'll ask me a lot of basketball questions and what I think. I haven't got one of those from the NBA. Everything the NBA guys want to know is about Jackson's character, how he handled teachers at Moeller, how he got along with his parents, his siblings, how he dealt with adversity. They would want me to tell them a story of adversity and how he dealt with it. And they're pretty thorough in that. So I found that interesting. And almost every NBA team that's called me has been very similar in the questions that they've asked.
So can you then turn around and use those conversations when you talk to your current players about the expectations and why all the things that you have as your core values, why those things are important? Because a lot of times I think it's sometimes difficult with young kids, with high school kids, to get them to see why being a good person with high character is important. Because sometimes we all know as kids, right, you know, we prioritize different things than we do once we get to be an adult. We kind of have a better idea of how things work. So have you been able to reference those conversations that you had with NBA teams and say, look, here's why, here's a guy who's going to probably earn a living as a basketball player in the NBA, yes, who came through our program, and yet NBA teams aren't really concerned with his basketball skill. Obviously, you have to have a certain level of skill and athleticism to be able to get to that point where you're being considered. But the greater point is that it's his character that's ultimately going to determine his success in the league, because there's lots of guys with athletic talent and basketball skill that are out there that never collect an NBA paycheck. So have you been able to use that with your current crop of players?
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt, Mike. I mean, they're clearly interested in his basketball acumen, but they're not that interested in my assessment of that acumen. But they are interested in, just as you were saying, anytime you're going to invest, and I think any company would be this way, if you're going to invest millions of dollars into an asset for your company, you're going to check it out in every way possible and understand all those intangibles are probably even more important. So, yeah, I actually have talked to him about that. And we're constantly, you know, that's a big theme in our locker room anyway. That's something that, I think if you had an opportunity to be around our program, you would see, we just typically, guys that don't get those things aren't going to be in our program for 4 years. It's just not going to happen. We're not going to, you know, we're not going to sacrifice what we believe in for a good player. And, I've talk to kids, and again, this isn't my original statement, but I've said to guys, hey, if you're asking me to choose between you or what we believe in, I made that decision 30 years ago, and it's not you. I mean, we're gonna do what we believe in, and I think our guys buy into that.
Yeah, I think you have to do what's right for your program, and ultimately, when you frame the decisions around what's best for our program, I think you end up making the right decision. And one of the things I always like to say is, if you're doing things right and you're doing things that you believe in and that allow you to put your head down on the pillow at night and sleep well, then you're not going to make everyone happy. There's going to be people who are unhappy because they disagree with whatever your philosophy is on a variety of different things. But when you've made the decision that this is what we believe in and you know your why behind it, then it's easy to make those decisions of program over individual. And I think when you set that up right from the very beginning, like you just said, you're in a much better position to be able to justify is the wrong word, but you're just in a much better position to be able to make those decisions for the good of the program than you would have been otherwise, without any question.
No doubt.
All right. So one more question about Jackson, and that is, did he come to Moeller? Did he start there as a freshman?
Yeah, I mean, Mike, I think his story is one of the most fascinating things. I've never seen anything like it in my career. Maybe you can look at C.J. McCollum a little bit. C.J. McCollum, if you look at pictures of him when he was at Canton Glen Oak, he was actually in the state tournament when we were in the state tournament in 2007. Now I'm watching him in the NBA. He was such a little guy. He was such a late bloomer. You know, in fact, I showed some of my kids today at Moeller. Here was C.J. McCollum playing in 2007, and he just looks like a third grader. And, you know, every kid develops differently. So Jackson Hayes comes to Moeller his freshman year, and I knew Jackson. I knew his dad. I knew his uncle. His dad and his uncle were coaches for the Bengals, and great big guys, great people, just an awesome family. And Jackson was about 6'1" tall, probably 125, but he had these really high hips, super long arms, big hands. You knew he was going to be a monster someday, but he just wasn't physically mature at all. You know, hadn't started puberty. He just, you know, but you knew he was going to be good. Literally, I would tell you that, you know, on that freshman team that we had, we keep 20 guys and we play two schedules. Play a blue schedule, which most of our top kids play in that schedule. And then we play a gold schedule, which maybe the bottom 10 play in more developmental. Jackson was definitely in that developmental part. Now, he is the only kid in a freshman gold game to ever have a dunk. He stole the ball and got a dunk his freshman year, but he, which is a bit unusual, but, you know, just really, you know, not basketball ready, really hadn't played a ton. With his dad being a coach for the Bengals, he really saw himself more as a football player. But again, he wasn't filled out. He wasn't really able to get a lot done on the football field. Comes back his sophomore year. Now he's about 6'4", and he's on our JV team. We keep 12 sophomores on that team, and he's starting to play. You know, he's in the rotation. He's not starting, but he's in the rotation his sophomore year. He plays football again. He's just still not ready. He can't really, he's a wide receiver. He can't really get off blocks yet, I guess. So he's not playing a ton there. His junior year, he comes to us. Now he's about 6'7", 6'8". And he's starting to fill out and he's starting to bounce. And he ends up playing, you know, he makes our varsity and he ends up getting in a rotation. I had a kid named Raleigh Voss who played in front of him, who's now playing at Cornell. Raleigh was really, really a great high school player. And so he came off the bench for us that year. Now we went to the, we were undefeated that whole season, went to the state finals. Raleigh actually got mono during the tournament. We didn't know it until the end, but he was sick throughout the whole tournament. Jackson played a ton for us his junior year. And then now he's maybe 6'8", maybe. By the time spring comes, I'm not kidding you, 6'10". And he's playing in AAU, and he made the decision just to concentrate on basketball. And I'm telling you, just blew up. And by the end of the spring, he's got about 20 Division I offers. Now, albeit, understand, he's never started a game at Moeller High School yet. And that summer, he even blew up more. I mean, you name it, they're calling me. When we started our open gyms in September, I think our first open gym, I opened the doors and Calipari comes walking in. And he'd had such an incredible summer. And by that point, I think Texas was a little bit ahead and he ends up committing to Texas. But I guess my point is this kid, you know, was getting D1 offers before he even started a game in high school. He was just such an incredibly late bloomer. I've never seen anything like it. And of course, his senior year, he's one of the top players in the state. I mean, he led us to a state championship, and we were pretty good that year, and ended up beating Seoul in the state finals.
That's incredible. So my follow up question was going to be, at what point did you realize that he might have the potential to be your first NBA player? And I'm guessing that just from the timeline that you laid out, kind of that summer after his junior year, I'm guessing is when maybe you started to say, did you realize that he was that much different maybe from guys that you had coached before, just from a size, athleticism combination that might give him an opportunity to play in the NBA?
Yeah, in all honesty, I will tell you, even when I saw him play in eighth grade, and he was like, he wasn't a starter in eighth grade, but I remember saying to his dad, he's going to be a monster someday. You know, you can tell how a kid's built.
Yep.
When he grows into all that, he's just going to be so long and athletic. But I wasn't dreaming about the lottery. I mean, that never even entered my mind. And I would say, really, when he got to our varsity his junior year, even in practice, he would have a chase down block. He would even have a catch. He always had great hands. He would have a catch. We're like, whoa. He was just very raw in learning the game. He had a lot of the game to learn. But I'm telling you, once it started to come, I've just never seen a guy improve. Even this year, I think the Texas coaches did an amazing job. I tip my hat to Shaka and Darren Horn. I would watch every week that he'd be playing. And I was just fascinated by how much better his closeouts got, you know, how much better he beat people to spots in the post. He really, it was amazing to me in college watching him pick up the game so fast. And again, I've never seen anything like it. I mean, it's, you know, and even the guys who were recruiting him at the end of his senior year or at the end of his junior season into his senior season, none of those guys were talking about one and done. They were talking about red shirt or, you know, he'll be a developmental guy. And now, you know, 1 year later, he's a one and done kid. It's amazing.
So I want to ask you about what, besides obviously the physical growth and the development there, can you talk a little bit about what his work ethic was like and what it took for him to develop the basketball skills that were necessary to get him to the level that he is today?
Yeah, so I don't think basketball was his first love until we made that tournament run his junior year, and he made the decision, I'm going all basketball. And when he made that decision, it, to me, it was amazing just how his his skills really started to come together. So I think it was really that he was a very raw player until the end of his junior year. You know, the one advantage that Jackson has, and where I feel very good, you know, he just turned 19. He played his whole freshman year at Texas at 18 years old, just turned 19 about a month ago. And, you know, you worry about a 19-year-old going into the NBA, but he's got incredible parents. His mom was an incredible player. His mom averaged 50 points a game when she was in high school. And then she went to Drake and had a great college career. And then Jonathan, the dad, was a great football player, I believe, at Oklahoma. And then coaching all those years in the NFL, coaching for the Bengals, I think Jackson was able to be down there and see Chad Johnson and see, you know, he's been around the pro game. And I think he's, even though it was football, I think that's going to give him advantage going into all this. And dad's going to live with him wherever they go. I know that.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I think, you know, we forget a lot of times, you know, we're watching the lottery tonight and you see Zion sitting there and you see RJ Barrett sitting there and yep. You forget that those guys are 18 and 19 years old. And when I think back to what I was like when I was 18 or 19 and all of a sudden I'm going to go in the NBA and make millions of dollars and be living in some city far away from where I grew up. And I think if, you know, if you have a rock solid family behind you, I think it can only make things easier for that transition. So that's great to hear that's something that will happen. There's a lot to be said for genetics, right, Carl?
In fact, I've always said, people, you know, you think that kid will be good? I said, well, I invest a lot in DNA. Good. I think that's a big factor. But there are a lot of factors, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's piggyback off that and talk a little bit about the parents that are part of your program and how you go about engaging them, involving them in what you're trying to do. Because obviously, if you're going to have a strong culture, if you're going to have the type of program that you've been able to build at Moeller, you got to have parents that are bought into what you're doing. So how do you go about bringing your parents on board and making them feel like they're a part of the program and keeping them positive and being supporters of what you're trying to do?
Yeah. So, you know what I would say? I mean, when we started, I remember one of my very first meetings with the parents. And remember, now, my first full season at Moeller, we went 6-15. And I always tell coaches this today. I mean, you build it over time. Don't even worry about your record early. Hopefully you have a good administration that sees what you're doing. It's all about building the culture. Don't worry about wins and losses. Do it the right way. Treat the kids right. Build it the right way. And I remember meeting with the parents, and you know, there were a lot of questions like, you know, hey, we need new uniforms. The football team has new uniforms, and the football team travels this way. And I remember stopping them, saying, you know what, we're not going to go that direction. It's not going to be what someone else has. We're not competing with anyone in this building. We're competing with St. X and LaSalle and Elder, our rival schools in our league. And if we want something, we're going to find a way to go get it. And that became kind of our mantra. If we want it, if we want to be first class, we're going to find a way to go get it. So we started having mulch sales and every fundraiser you could imagine to try to get the things that I think, you know, said to our kids that this is a first-rate program. And again, it just built over time. We've got a media guide now that's totally done by our parents. 100% our parents sell all the ads. We have a guy who likes to put it together, but it's been a parent-driven project. And I think for the third year in a row, we've won the best in the nation. It's about a 180-page book. I could send it to you, Mike, but it just evolved over all these years, and the parents have taken pride in doing that. And I just think that's the way. I think we're lucky at Moeller. Most of our parents get it. They understand where it's appropriate to be involved in the program, and that's helping sell split the pot. That's helping us do the program and all that. Our parents, I rarely deal with a parent who wants to come and talk to me about their son's playing time. It is so rare for that to happen in our program. And I just think it's that culture got established over the years, and it's worked well for us. But I think you have to have the parents. Like I want to know who the parents are, and I want them to know who I am. And again, I think the trip I talked about before, those kind of things allow that to happen.
Yeah, I think the relationship piece of it that we talked about earlier with your players, I think that extends to having that relationship with the parents, because if you build that relationship at first, before there are issues, before there are problems, which, yes, you know, the media guide and the trip and all those things that helps people to get to know you and get to know your program and get to know each other. You know, then when there is something that a parent might potentially be upset about or have a question about, if you have that previous relationship established, it becomes much easier to go back after the fact and have that difficult conversation that you might have to have that, again, you've had rarely, but that you do have to have occasionally.
Yep.
And when you do, if you have a relationship that starts from a feeling of respect on both sides, it becomes much easier to be able to explain whatever, yes, the difficult situation might be, as opposed to it's somebody that you've talked to once and said hello and you don't really know them at all. It becomes much easier to interpret things wrong or take things the wrong way than with somebody who you've sat down and had breakfast with in Florida, you know, during a team trip. It's just, it just makes things much, much easier, I'm sure.
Yeah. And you know, the other thing I think has been good over the years is even the recruiting process. And I think if parents, and this are kids that they may be D1 players or they may be D3 players, but if parents see that our staff is investing in those kids and trying to help get them to the next level and doing that, I just think they know you care about them. And I think that helps build a positive, just a positive rapport with the parents in the program.
Absolutely. All right. I want to piggyback on an indirectly related to parents question. And that is, obviously, with the number of players that you've been able to send to college basketball over the years, can you talk a little bit about how good a player has to be in order to be able to play even at the Division III level as a college basketball player? Because I think there's a lot of misconceptions. And obviously, here we're not talking to high school coaches as our audience, but talking to any parent who may be listening out there, just what it means to be able to play college basketball in terms of the skill level that you have to have in order to be able to do that.
Yeah. You know, Mike, it's funny. I've always said that if I have more time, one thing I'd like to do is organize outings of our entire parents, particularly our freshman parents, don't seem to understand it, and take them to Division II basketball games or Division III basketball. They have no clue how good you have to be to play at those levels. And it's always amazed me. I would have parents of a pretty average 6 foot, you know, 6 foot guard and, you know, decent high school player, maybe similar to me when I was back at Miami East, but saying to me, you know, Coach, I know I can't play at UC or Xavier, but, you know, I think I'd like to go play at, you know, Finley College, and they have no idea how good you have to be,
yep,
to play at Finley. And so one of the things I do think is important in my role and the role of all of our coaches, we do try to get kids to understand that a little bit. You know, where they fit in. And there are places to have a good basketball experience. We probably have three or four kids right now playing in Division III who are having great success, and they're enjoying the heck out of it. And again, you have to be so good to play Division III. I mean, and most of our parents don't get that right away. We have to work at that a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's definitely an educational process that, yes, people, you know, you see it. And I've been honestly more involved at the youth level of basketball than I have been at the high school basketball level over the last several years, just because of the involvement of my own kids. Mm-hmm. And I get to hear lots of people who are very, very unrealistic about
yes.
where their kid is going to end up and what the ultimate end game is for whether it's their son or their daughter. And I think that whenever I talk to people, I always just try to make the statement of, you know, you have no idea how good you have to be to play college basketball at any level. I'm like, yes. go watch Case Western Reserve play basketball. Go watch yes. John Carroll play basketball. Go watch Baldwin Wallace play basketball. And you'll get an idea of how good those teams and those kids are. And I think if more parents would just go out and watch one Division III game, they'd come back with a much more realistic evaluation of where their own child is in terms of their future basketball career. And that's not to kill anyone's dream, because certainly we want you to work as hard as you can and try to achieve and get to the highest level that you possibly can in the game. But it's also important to be realistic, like you said, when you have the, you know, the 6-foot guard who averages 6 points a game in high school, you know, the odds of Kentucky making that phone call are pretty slim, and they're probably pretty slim for Case Western or, you know, yes. any other Division III school making that same call. So it's just, again, I think you have to be very, very good to be able to play college basketball.
One thing I've tried to get parents to understand, it's really, really tough, and kids too. I think kids who come into high school that have great experience, they really coming from, a lot of times it's their parents really understand what it's about and their expectations are right. I see kids who come in and the parents are thinking, my kid's got to get a scholarship and he's got to go play in college and he's got to be a starter. And those kids have kind of tough high school experiences. There's just a lot of false pressure on them. If there's the expectation from the parent, look, if all that happens, it's gravy, but I want my kid to learn about life. Basketball is the greatest classroom in the world. I want him to be a great teammate. And they have that mindset. All the stuff will happen that if it's supposed to, and a kid has so much of a better experience. And I try to talk to our parents about that, having the right expectation, you know, of playing high school basketball.
Yeah, I think the totality of the experience, I think it's something that, too, as a parent, I've developed a different outlook on what basketball is, because for so long I looked at it through my lens as a player and then as a coach and sort of what my experience was, and thought that everybody wanted that same experience that I went after. And the reality is that they don't. My own kids don't. The kids that I coach don't necessarily want the same experience that I had. And so you start to look at it and you say, what are you trying to get out of? And this is me speaking as a parent. What do I want my kids to get out of their basketball experience? And I want exactly what you just described, which is
yes.
I want them to learn life lessons. I want them to be great teammates. I want them to learn the value of toughness, the value of hard work. And if the byproduct of that is something beyond the experience, great. But to me, ultimately, it becomes that experience is really what it's all about for my kids, because, you know, you want them to be successful. I go back to what, you know, you said about Jackson here, you know, a few minutes ago. You hope he has a great NBA career, but more importantly than that, you want him to be a great human being. You want him to be a great person, because even if he has a 15-year NBA career, he's going to retire when he's 35 years old and have the rest of his life to live. And you want him to be a high quality, high character guy.
Right.
And that's really what we're trying to produce as parents, as coaches, as people who are involved in the game. To me, that's really what it's all about.
No doubt. 100%. And I do feel good about Jackson Hayes being that kid who's going to do it the right way.
And that's what it's all about. I want to wrap up here, Carl, by asking you one more question. And obviously you've been able to have, over the course of your career, a tremendous amount of success in the state tournament. So is there anything that a high school coach out there could learn from what you do at Moeller that you feel helps prepare your team to have success in the postseason? Is there one or two things that you can think of off the top of your head that sort of lead to the success that you've been able to have at the state tournament level?
You know, and not mean to be flip, obviously, we, you know, it starts with having great players, and we've had great players, so I don't want to act like there's any magical coach.
Are you saying you have to have talent to win, Carl? Yeah, is that what you're saying here?
Yeah. So I want to be pretty upfront about that. But I would share this with guys, and I do it quite a bit. When we got it rolling in the 90s. We started winning league championships. This is our first decade, and our league was really good back then with St. X and LaSalle, and everyone in our league was really elder, was really strong. And we started winning leagues, but we were kind of getting knocked out of the tournament earlier than I wanted. You know, maybe the sectional final or districts, and it was hard. And this was before we did the super sectional down here. That's much more fair. I don't know why they don't do it in the Northeast, but we do the super sectional down here, which makes it more fair, I think, for teams that have great regular seasons. But we weren't playing well, and I was just wondering, why weren't we playing our best ball in March? And I kind of went on a campaign. I wrote letters to different coaches in college that I thought played well at the end of every year. And I got great stuff back from guys. And the one thing that most of them told me was about having fresh legs and fresh minds. And, again, I think I came out of that era when I first started about three-hour practices. And, heck, I used to do all that. We would practice every day in November, Thanksgiving Day. We'd have three-hour practices. And I would tell you today, we give a lot more days off. We're a lot more careful about where our guys are, mental fatigue and physical fatigue as we go through the season, and really try to. And I would tell you, and I've got this from different coaches, but when we're in late January, February, you know, we're 75-minute practices. We really get it cut back. Now, early in the year, we get after pretty good. You got so much to do in a short high school season. But I think that has really helped us in terms of playing with. I just think you can look at teams, right, Mike, and you can see if there's enthusiasm and joy, if you see it in practice, because they know it's going to be a 75-minute practice.
Right.
You get so much more accomplished. It just, you know, a feeling gets going. So that's the one thing I would advise any young coaches. Be careful about how you're beating your guys down as the season goes along.
Yeah, I think guys are much better about that in general than they were in the past. I think there's much more information and knowledge out there that, you know, when you wear your guys down to the bone, you're just not going to get the best performance out of them. So I think that's a great piece of advice to wrap up on. Before we get out of here, Carl, would you please share out how people can get in contact with you after listening to the podcast, if they just want to reach out and talk some basketball with you? And then if there's any other parting shot that we didn't talk about tonight that you want to get out there before we get out, go ahead and do that now as well.
Well, I can be reached at my email is C. Kramer, K-R-E-M-E-R, so Carl Kramer, ckramer@moeller.org. And, anyone can reach out. I'm not always the best at getting back quickly. You even know that, Mike. but I will definitely do that. And I love talking with coaches. I guess for me, Mike, you and I talked about this earlier, but I want to say thank you to you. For a coach, you love to have an opportunity to talk about the things you believe in and talk about your program. So this has been a lot of fun for me, and I appreciate you and Jason having me on, and I'll keep listening to your podcast.
Well, we appreciate that. It's been a pleasure to be able to talk to you, especially a guy who's had so much success right here in our home state of Ohio. And we can't thank you enough for spending an hour and a half or so tonight with us. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Head Start Basketball's Player Development Academy offers Cleveland area players a unique opportunity to improve their basketball skills. Regardless of a player's age, skill level, or position, training with Head Start Basketball will elevate your game to the next level. Do you want to improve your ball handling, become a better shooter, or develop into a more skilled, confident player? Our academy classes offer training that's designed to do just that. Our training sessions are innovative and will have you learning skills that are transferable to actual games. we have four different class skill levels for boys and girls, ages 4 and up. All Player Development Academy classes will be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center. For more information or to get registered, please visit www.headstartbasketball.com.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast presented by Head Start Basketball.